from the nation's capital, for National Public Radio, this is Josh Darcy speaking to you from the International Conference Room at the State Department. With events in the Middle East and Indochina reaching critical junctures, Secretary of State Henry Kissinger is about to hold what could be one of the most significant news conferences of his career. Since the breakdown this past weekend of his Egyptian-Israeli diplomatic efforts, Dr. Kissinger has arrived home only to learn about still further unfortunate developments. Even while a reassessment of our Middle Eastern policy was announced, the news came from Riyadh in Saudi Arabia that King Faisal had been assassinated, thus plunging that part of the world into even greater uncertainties. And in Indochina, the news continues to get worse each day. The ancient Vietnamese capital of Hue has now been abandoned by Saigon's forces. Da Nang, the country's second largest city, is imperiled. A huge U.S. commercial airlift is about to commence to get the secretary the refugees out of Da Nang. And now here is the secretary.
Suspension of the Middle East peace talk. The step-by-step approach pursued by the United States attempted to separate the Middle East problem into individual and therefore manageable segments. Now that approach has suffered a setback, and the Middle East issues have to be dealt with comprehensively under more difficult circumstances. A moment of potentially grave danger is not the time to assess blame between the parties or to indulge in recrimination. We need a calm appraisal of the situation and a United States policy best suited to the new conditions. Let me sum up the United States position. With the end of this step-by-step approach, the United States faces a period of more complicated international diplomacy. Consequently, a reassessment of policy is essential. This reassessment has been ordered by the President. The dangers which produced the need for progress towards peace are still with us. The United States, therefore, is determined to continue the search for peace in the Middle East. It is prepared to go to Geneva and will be in touch with the co-chairman of the conference, the USSR, in the near future. The United States is prepared to consider any other approach acceptable to the parties. The United States remains fully committed to the survival of Israel. The search for peace can be nurtured only in an atmosphere of calm. The parties involved in the Middle East conflict thus have a responsibility to moderate words and deeds and to refrain from threatening acts. All outside powers have a responsibility to exercise restraint and to follow a course of moderation. We face a difficult situation in the Middle East and throughout the world. The times demand a renewed sense of national purpose. We must understand that peace is indivisible. The United States cannot pursue a policy of selective reliability. We cannot abandon friends in one part of the world without jeopardizing the security of friends everywhere. We cannot master our future except as a united people. Our energies should be directed not at recriminations about the past, but toward a vigorous and constructive search for a lasting peace. And to this, the administration is dedicated. Now I'll take questions and answers.
Mr. Secretary, with respect to American policy, what you have just said regarding selective reliability, in 1965, the United States equated the defense of Vietnam with the commitment to NATO. Now it appears to be equating the traditional aid to South Vietnam with regard to the Middle East and so forth. Do you feel that during the past 5 years, the policy and the techniques of diplomacy which we have pursued have been wrong? Have the conditions been wrong, or what has happened?
As I understand it, you're asking two separate questions. One is the policy, the relationship between Indochina and other parts of the world. And the second is whether the policies pursued in the last 5 years have been wrong. First, let me talk.
I didn't mean policies, I mean strategy.
Well, that's a distinction without much difference.
In what way?
Well, if the strategy is wrong, I don't see how you can have the right strategy and the wrong policies, or the wrong strategy and the right policies. So let me answer your question. With respect to Indochina, we are not equating the intrinsic importance of each part of the world. And we are not saying that every part of the world is strategically as important to the United States as any other part of the world. The problem we face in Indochina today is an elementary question of what kind of a people we are. For 15 years, we have been involved in encouraging the people of Vietnam to defend themselves against what we conceived as external danger. In 1973, we negotiated a settlement in which we withdrew our forces and in return achieved the release of our prisoners. This settlement, it is well to recall now, was, while we were negotiating it, generally criticized for our holding out for stronger terms. The fact of the matter is that now that we have withdrawn our forces and have obtained the release of our prisoners, there was never any question that the United States would continue to give economic and military aid to Vietnam. And what we face now is whether the United States not just will withdraw its forces, which we achieved, and not just will stop the end of the loss of American life, but whether it will deliberately destroy an ally by withholding aid from it in its moment of extremity. This is a fundamental question of how we are viewed by all other people. And it has nothing to do with the question of whether we should ever have gotten involved there in the first place. Now, with respect to whether the basic policies have been correct in the last 5 years. That, of course, is a rather sweeping question which would require an answer that could easily occupy the better part of this press conference. With respect to Indochina, I would urge people to look at the newspapers and the public debate during the period that these agreements were being negotiated to see what the imperatives were on the administration in negotiating these settlements. And that the general conviction was that the United States had done enough in expending American life, and that the people of Vietnam should have an opportunity to defend themselves without American support. There was never any proposition that the United States should withdraw and cut off aid. And these agreements were negotiated on the assumption that there would be, that the United States would continue economic and military aid to South Vietnam, and also that there would be some possibility of enforcing the agreements And this is the basic problem with the policy in Vietnam. With respect to other policies, I would rather answer specific questions. Yes,
Secretary, if I may follow up on that question. It appears that Congress, at least, has felt that the Nixon Doctrine has outlived itself, and that now that supplies will not be provided as had been committed by the United States in the past. Do you plan to reassess the alternatives as a result of the demise of the Nixon Doctrine, particularly in reference to Vietnam, Cambodia, and Thailand?
We have to face the fact that there are many countries in the world which have no conceivable opportunity to defend themselves without American economic or military assistance. And therefore, if it becomes our national policy that that countries must at some point be able to rely entirely on their resources, we will have brought about a massive change in the international environment that in time will fundamentally threaten the security of the United States as well as the security of many of our friends. The so-called Nixon Doctrine was based on the assumption that the United States would help those countries that were prepared to help themselves. If this is no longer true, then we are likely to find a massive shift in the foreign policies of many countries and a fundamental threat over a period of time to the security of the United States.
Secretary, how serious did you find in your Middle East negotiations the concern on the Arab, on the Egyptian and Israeli sides, the problems you're facing in getting aid for Indochina? Was this a factor in the breakdown of the talks?
I cannot assign any particular cause for the breakdown of the talks. There's no question that events in Portugal, Greece, Turkey, and Indochina had an effect on the conduct of the negotiations. On the part of our friends, it raised the question of the durability of our assurances. And since one of our problems was to substitute American assurances for some physical terrain features, this was a factor. On the part of those who were threatening our friends, there was the feeling that perhaps concessions were less necessary because the drift of events was in any case favorable. Nevertheless, I think that the major reason for the breakdown of the negotiations was intrinsic to the negotiations themselves, but the surrounding circumstances were certainly not favorable.
Mr. Secretary.
Yes.
To pursue the question of the interrelationship of Indochina and other portions of the world, where does the administration go from here? It is clearly at loggerheads with the Congress on this fundamental question. The United States policy, according to the administration, apparently is immobilized diplomatically on Indochina. Is there any way over this barrier except a constant head-on clash with Congress?
I don't agree that United States policy is immobilized over Indochina. There is a philosophical disagreement which I have attempted to explain earlier. I have believed ever since I came to Washington that it is overwhelmingly in our national interest to put the debate on Indochina behind us. The administration has proposed to the Congress a three-year program for phasing out American military aid to Vietnam, and which would, if the Congress and the administration can agree, remove this issue from the yearly congressional executive battles. I believe, as I pointed out, that we face a grave situation. The administration cannot give up its conviction simply for the sake of a technical compromise. But we believe that this three-year program, if the levels are adequate, might provide an opportunity to get the debate behind us.
Is the reassessment of U.S. policy toward the whole Middle East primarily aimed at prompting Israel to adopt a more relaxed or less intransigent negotiating posture?
At this moment, there are no negotiations going on, and therefore we would have no concrete proposals to make to Israel, even if Israel asked us what negotiating posture it should adopt. The assessment of our policy that is now going on is made necessary by the new circumstances. Our policy had been designed to, as I pointed out in this statement, to segment the issues into individual elements, to negotiate each element separately, and therefore to permit each party to adjust itself domestically and internationally to a process of a gradual approach towards peace. Now that this approach has to be abandoned, we face an entirely new situation in which, in all probability, all problems will have to be negotiated simultaneously, and in which, instead of a forum in which Israel deals with one Arab country through the mediation of the United States, the strong probability is that Israel will have to deal with all Arab countries in a multilateral forum. The assessment of our policy is not directed against Israel. It is not designed to induce Israel to alter any particular policy. It is designed to develop a position that the United States can take in order to prevent an increasing radicalization in the area and an increasing tension, and above all, in order to avoid a war in which inevitably the United States would be involved, at least indirectly, given the international circumstances.
You and your spokesman have denied that this reassessment contemplates a cutoff. I don't think anybody has denied that it might contemplate a reduction in response.
There is no level of aid right now that has been set for next year's for the next year, and therefore the question of a reduction is an entirely academic one. We have before us an Israeli request of rather large size, which at this moment is being staffed on the entirely technical level and has been staffed on the entirely technical level for weeks. It has not yet reached either my desk or the president's desk. We will make our decisions on aid to Israel on the basis of our national objectives and on the basis of the statement I made here that we remain committed to the survival of Israel. Of course, whatever conclusions we come to will be submitted to the Congress, and the Congress can make its independent judgment. We are not approaching the reassessment with an attitude of cutting aid, and we are approaching it with the attitude of looking at the overall situation in the Middle East to determine what the best course might be.
Secretary, now that you've written an obituary on step-by-step negotiating, does that mean that you're writing off the possibility of unilateral American action in the Middle East? Are you now going to be walking step-by-step with the Soviet Union? What will be your approach?
Our approach will be whatever is most likely to lessen the dangers of war and to produce steps towards peace. As I pointed out in our statement, the United States is prepared to go to Geneva. The United States is prepared also to go along with any other approach that the parties may request of it. So we are not insistent on any particular approach. We will follow whatever approach is most likely to be effective and is requested by the parties. The obvious forum that is now open is Geneva, but we are prepared to look at other approaches.
Could you say, when you go to Geneva, would it not be likely that the talks would themselves become segmented into the various problems, and that would provide an opportunity for the United States or other parties to play a role in each individual problem? Israel, Egypt, Israel, Syria, Israel, Jordan.
If that is the turn that the negotiations take, the United States will be prepared to participate in it. The United States has no fixed idea on which course to pursue. At this moment, we have to consult with the other parties, and we, of course, also have to consult now with the co-chairman of the Geneva Conference. The United States will do what is most likely to reduce the danger of war and to promote peace, and if it should turn out that separate negotiations develop at Geneva, the United States will certainly support them.
Secretary, to what extent has...
Well, go ahead and then you...
You adverted to difficulties in Portugal, Greece, Turkey, Indochina. One could add the dismemberment of Ethiopia by an Arab coalition, the sellout of the Kurds, and so on. To what extent do you consider this...
I like
this
long the difficulties with... What do you want me to say, yes?
With this reflected what Dr. Schlesinger described as a worldwide perception of American influence?
I have pointed out at many press conferences over the years that the central authority of a major country cannot be under persistent attack without ultimately paying a price in foreign policy. We have gone through the experience of Vietnam, through the anguish of Watergate, and I think the cumulative effect of nearly a decade of domestic upheaval is beginning to take its toll. Foreign governments, when they deal with the United States, make a bet in their dealings on the constancy of American policy and on the ability of the United States to carry through on whatever it is we promise or fail to promise or threaten. And this is one of the big problems in foreign policy today. It is not a problem of the Congress at this particular moment, because the executive also shares a responsibility for it over a period of a decade. At this moment, it is senseless to try to assess the blame. At this moment, the great need is to pull together and to see whether we can restore a sense of national purpose. And as far as the administration is concerned, we will do our utmost to do this in a cooperative spirit.
Mr. Secretary, it seems to me that part of the national debate over Vietnam has come about because of what might be called the light at the end of the tunnel syndrome. And now you're suggesting that possibly the 3 more years of aid, the Indochina question could be more satisfactorily resolved. Isn't this just another way of buying yet another slice of time?
Well, Mr. Carter, my own personal conviction, about which I have left no question, is that the right way to do it is to vote annually what is necessary. There are some problems in the world that simply have no terminal date. And in Indochina, as long as the North Vietnamese are determined to attack, it is not responsible to say that there is an absolute date at which an end can be achieved. On the other hand, given the very strong feelings in the Congress, given the cataclysmic or the very dangerous impact on the United States position in the world of destroying a country where we have lost 50,000 men, where we have fought for 10 years, and which we as a country projected into this conflict, we are prepared to go to a 3-year program in which, with adequate aid, we believe that there is at least a chance that then, with the development of oil resources and other factors, that this country could be put on a more self-sustaining basis. It is our offer in order to take Vietnam out of the national debate for this period, and in order to avoid what we think would be a very grievous blow to the United States. Yes,
sir. In another part of the world, this is a question about your projected trip to Latin America. Is it still on? And what is the main purpose of the trip, and whom do you expect to see down there?
I have planned a trip to Latin America for the last 6 months. And as I pointed out in a speech in Houston a few weeks ago, the United States attaches great importance to its relationships to Latin America, with which we have had the longest uninterrupted tradition of foreign policy in our history. and which a part of the world which is in the position somewhere between the less developed nations and the advanced nations, with which we share many cultural and political traditions. And therefore, we have believed that Western Hemisphere policy is a central part of our overall policy and a test of our relationship to many of the less developed countries. Now, I am planning to go to I will definitely go to Latin America before the meeting of the OAS here in May. So I will definitely go in April. Given the various pressures that exist right now in Washington, I am not in a position to announce the exact date, but we will determine that within the next few days. But it is definite that I will go in April. I'm planning to visit Argentina, Brazil, Peru, Chile, and Venezuela. And I plan to visit other Latin American countries later this year.
Secretary, if the Geneva Peace Conference ends in stalemate, as everybody seems to think it will, how great will the danger of another war in the Middle East be? And in that connection, do you expect that Egypt and Syria to allow United Nations troops to remain in the buffer zone between them and Israel?
Let me take this in two parts. The longer there is a stalemate in the Middle East, the greater the danger of war becomes. The danger of war can best be reduced in the Middle East if all of the parties see a prospect of peace somewhere down the road and some plausible means of attaining it. And this is why we pursued the previous approach. When the United States goes to Geneva, it will not go there with the attitude that it will end in a stalemate, but rather with the attitude of seeing whether this forum can now be turned into an arena for constructive progress. And therefore, the United States will go there with a positive attitude, and it will ask all parties concerned to go there with a similar attitude, keeping in mind the needs and requirements of everybody. Was there another part of your question?
So what do you expect Egypt and Syria to do about the United Nations?
About the United Nations. Well, we believe that the United Nations Emergency Force in Egypt and the United Nations Disengagement Service Force in Syria were essential components of the disengagement agreements. We hope that the mandates of both of these will be renewed as a contribution to peace and stability in the Middle East and to permit the process of negotiations to go forward in a tranquil atmosphere.
In as much as we deal with every communist country in the world, with the exception of Cuba today, why would we, to use your words, be destroying South Vietnam if it became communist?
Well, on that theory, we can give up all of our alliances because we would not be destroying any ally if it were overrun by a communist country. It is not a question of our not dealing with communist countries. It is a question of countries that obviously have a desire to defend themselves, being prevented from defending themselves by an American decision to withhold supplies. And therefore, we would be destroying those people who have resisted, whom we have encouraged to resist, by such an action. I think it is interesting also to point out that, after all, the flood of refugees in Vietnam is going away from the communist area of control. And even in Cambodia, under conditions that one would have to say are extraordinarily discouraging, somebody is still fighting around Phnom Penh. So that we are here in a position where the United States is forcing people to surrender by withholding supplies.
Secretary, Egypt, according to a senior American official, was willing to sign a pledge not to have recourse to force in the Middle East, that force was not the way to resolve the conflict in the Middle East, to refrain from military and paramilitary activities and to allow Israel the right to renew any agreement at the expiration of its one-year term. In your view, did those concessions by Egypt satisfy the military side of non-belligerency?
Well, the issue of non-belligerency is a complicated, it's a complicated legal position. Because non-belligerency is an international status which you cannot approach simply in components. I don't think any useful purpose is served for me to give an assessment of the various negotiating positions. Both sides made a serious effort and it and they did not succeed in bridging their differences.
What is the impact on the world oil situation? And is the United States prepared to go ahead with the...
You know, let me ask a question here.
Second, with the Consumer Producer Conference, is that about to take place? Would you discuss also the impact of King Faisal's assassination on that situation?
The world... of course, it is commonly believed that tensions in the Middle East do not particularly help the world oil situation. The United States has taken the position that it would conduct its negotiations in the Middle East independent of any oil pressures. And American policy will not let itself be affected by oil pressures. We do not see any developing at this moment. We believe that the Consumer Producer Conference is being conducted in the interest of both sides for the common benefit, for the interest of a developing and thriving world economy, which is in the interest of producers as well as consumers, and should not be tied to the situation in the Middle East. Therefore, we are proceeding with our preparations for the Consumer Producer Conference, progress is being made in that direction, and we find it essentially on schedule. King Faisal ruled a country of extraordinary importance to the energy picture of the world, and also due to his extraordinary personality, he had a major influence on all of the Arab countries, being one of the few Arab leaders with a major influence on both the moderates and the radical elements in the Arab world. King Faisal was an element for moderation in the negotiations between Israel and the Arab countries, and he was a friend of the United States. And his great personal prestige will be missed, even though we are convinced that the basic policies of Saudi Arabia are going to continue.
I'd like to follow up on the question about the light at the end of the tunnel that was raised here earlier by Mr. Kalka. It seemed to me that your answer to that question really was that you did, given a three-year program in South Vietnam, see another light at the end of that tunnel. And I think the real question that's involved here is whether the administration is perceiving reality. I think you have a problem with the public in this country. We've given 50,000 men, we've given $150 billion, and it hasn't saved South Vietnam. You're asking people now to believe that if you get three more years of help, you, Henry Kissinger, believe it can be saved. Now, I'd like to know if that is not telling people that you see a light at the end of the tunnel.
No, I'm saying that if you do not give enough, then you're bringing about consequences very similar to what we are now seeing. Since May last year, South Vietnam has received only ammunition and fuel. It has received almost no spare parts and no modern equipment. Under those conditions, the demoralization of an army is inevitable. And therefore, some of the consequences we now see are not surprising. I am saying that as a people, we should not destroy our allies, and that once we start on that course, it will have very serious consequences for us in the world. I have stated that it would be better if we did it on an annual basis. Given the enormous divisions that have arisen in this country, for the sake of avoiding these divisions, we are prepared to go the other route. It is not our first choice. The better course is to do it by determining each year what is necessary. And in the nature of things, there are many situations around the world in which the necessity of assistance depends on the degree of outside pressure. And if we cannot control the outside pressure, then our cutting off assistance means turning these countries over to their enemies.
Mr. Secretary,
could you give us your assessment of events in Portugal, what U.S. policy is toward Portugal, and whether it might have to change?
Well, Portugal, of course, is a member of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and has had close and friendly relationships with the United States. What seems to be happening in Portugal now is that the armed forces movement, which is substantially dominated by officers of leftist tendencies, has now appointed a new cabinet in which communists and parties closely associated with the communists have many of the chief portfolios. This was an evolution that was not unforeseeable over recent months, and it will, of course, raise questions for the United States in relationship to its NATO policy and to its policy with Portugal. With respect to NATO, this is a matter to be discussed with all of our allies, and we are in close contact with them. With respect to Portugal, the United States has a tradition of friendly relations with Portugal, and it has it does not intend to take the initiative in breaking these friendly relations. However, we are disquieted by an evolution in which there is a danger that the democratic process may become a sham, and in which parties are getting into dominant positions whose interests we would not have thought were necessarily friendly to the United States.
Mr. Secretary, you said earlier that in 1973, when the Vietnam Peace Accords were negotiated, there was no doubt about continuing U.S. military and economic assistance. What assurance did you have then, in 1973, that the Congress would continue?
We had no assurances. If you review now the nature of our domestic debate from 1969 to 1973, it was essentially that American involvement in Vietnam should be terminated, but that the Vietnamese should be given an opportunity to defend themselves. And the entire pressure of the domestic debate was on the withdrawal, at least insofar as I became conscious of it, was on the withdrawal of American participation. We stated on the date that the agreement was signed, if you read my press conference of that day, that economic and military aid would continue. And none of this was ever challenged in 73 and 74. In fact, the debate started this year over appropriating a sum of money that had already been authorized by the Congress, so that a question of principle could not possibly have been involved, because the authorization was approved last year with very little division. There were no assurances, but it seemed to us inherent in the whole posture that we had taken that this would continue.
I'd like to follow up on that. Did you give at that time the South Vietnamese government assurances that this aid would continue?
We told the South Vietnamese government, not a commitment of the United States, that aid would continue, but that in our judgment, if the South Vietnamese cooperated in permitting us to withdraw our forces and therefore to reclaim our prisoners, that in our judgment, the Congress would then vote the aid that would be necessary to sustain Vietnam economically and militarily. It was not given as an American commitment. We are not talking here of a legal American commitment. We are talking here of a moral commitment.
Secretary, do you think there will be another Middle East war?
I think there is always a danger of a Middle East war as long as the parties have such irreconcilable differences. We do not believe a Middle East war is inevitable. We believe a Middle East war would involve the gravest dangers to all of the countries concerned, as well as serious dangers of great power involvement. And therefore, the United States will work with determination to, and with confidence to avoid a war and to use its influence to promote a movement towards peace.
Sir, did you look at the record of the assassin of King Faisal? I'm sure you must have. And did you find, when he was in the United States, any input or anything that might have contributed to this action?
Frankly, I have not looked at the details. I've just seen a brief summary of the record of the assassin, but I'm absolutely confident that nobody in the United States had anything to do with such an action, because we considered King Faisal a good friend of the United States.
Why is there such a presumption in this country at this moment, in newspaper articles, in the meaning, in the interpretation of the reassessment of Mideast policy, that Israel somehow was at fault for the breakdown of the talks and should somehow be punished by a reduction in aid or some other matter?
Well, I cannot answer why people make certain assumptions. There were, many of you were on the plane with me, and you know how I attempted to explain the situation. The administration has made no assessment of blame, nor will it serve any useful purpose to engage in that now. Secondly, punishment of a friend cannot be the purpose of a national policy. We now face a new situation. No useful purpose is served by conducting it in a fit of pique or by encouraging even greater tensions in the area. We will make an assessment of the American national interest in relation to our long-term commitments and as well as the necessity of preserving the peace, and our policy will be based entirely on this, and in no sense is there any consideration given to punishing any particular country.
In that connection, going back to step-by-step approach once again, since you started this approach, there was an agreement between Egypt and Israel in January of 74, an agreement between Syria and Israel in May of 74, an enhancement of the American diplomatic position in the Middle East, and one setback. In light of the balance on the pluses and minuses, why so radical and dramatic a change, a need for a major reassessment of policy? Why not continue along the old way, recognizing that there was one setback, but a lot of pluses?
Because we, of course, have no... we obviously believe that there were large pluses. As I made clear before we went on this trip, it seemed to us that in any event, even if another step had succeeded, a reassembling of the Geneva Conference was the most likely next step, because we believed that the Geneva Conference would then have taken place under easier circumstances than will now be the case. We have made the assessment that the step-by-step approach, as it has been conducted up to now, is not likely to be able to be continued. And therefore, we have to assess where we go from here, under conditions in which some of the presuppositions are no longer valid. I don't consider anything particularly dramatic about assessing American policy when it finds itself in a new situation.
Secretary, you have used, I want to
You have used the word suspension to describe the talks, yet you said that the step-by-step approach has ended, and now you just say it's not likely to be able to continue. Is there any chance whatsoever that the negotiations between Israel and Egypt on an interim settlement, that is another step, can be revived?
My impression from Egyptian public statements is that this is extremely unlikely. Should, however, the parties request us to, against our expectations, to undertake it, we would be prepared to do it. But we are making no effort to urge the parties to do so. We stand ready if there should be any such request. Let Ms. Berger, and then you.
A question was being raised yesterday after your briefing to Congressman on the Hill as to who made that decision that the step-by-step approach is now finished. Was it your personal decision? Was it a decision of the parties? Could you tell us about how that decision was reached?
The Egyptian foreign minister announced on the evening that he announced the suspension of the talks that the step-by-step approach was now finished and that Egypt would return to Geneva. This is how the decision was reached. The United States will do whatever is necessary, whatever it can, and whatever the parties agree to promote peace in the Middle East. And if the parties should request us to do it, we would be willing to entertain it.
Secretary, would it, in your view, enhance the prospects of Geneva were the United States to move beyond the role of intermediary and take a publicly stated position on the substantive issues to be negotiated there?
Well, we have generally refrained from taking a position of our own because we felt that when the peace and security of countries is concerned, that they have to make their fundamental decisions. On a few occasions when the issues between them had narrowed sufficiently, the United States took a position. Now, whether in the evolution of the negotiations at Geneva or elsewhere, a moment will come when the United States should take a position of its own. That remains to be determined. We have not yet made this decision.
Thank you very much for all your trouble. I have one more question, but I didn't ask
it. Nor will he. Okay, that concludes Secretary Kissinger's news conference of this morning, which was devoted primarily to the Middle East and Indochina situations. But there also was an announcement that the secretary definitely was going to take the planned trip to Latin America in April, a trip that would include visits to Argentina, Brazil, Peru, Chile, and Venezuela. But, of course, the main questioning centered on the Mideast and Indochina, and the secretary assessing the breakdown of the talks in the Mideast this past weekend said that at this moment of potentially grave danger, this is no time to assess the blame for the breakdown of the talks. The secretary added that the U.S. remains fully committed to the survival of Israel, but that the reassessment of Middle Eastern policy will continue in the shadow of that negotiation breakdown, and that the question of $2.5 billion of Israeli aid asked by the Israelis for the next fiscal year will be considered, but the reassessment of Middle Eastern policy is not being approached with the idea of cutting off aid to Israel. So that matter stands in question as to what exactly will be considered. Also in question is precisely what the dynamics of the forthcoming conference in Geneva, probably to be held early this summer, will involve. The secretary generalized on that, stating that our approach is that whatever is best to lessen the danger of war will be our basic policy. He commented on King Faisal's death of yesterday, saying that Faisal was indeed a friend of the United States, but that he does not anticipate any basic change in Saudi Arabian policy towards the United States. The Indo-Chinese question, of course, was gone into at great length here by numerous reporters. The secretary alluded to this in answering a question on the Middle East by saying the U.S. cannot pursue a policy of selective reliability. This could be taken as a hint that those people who are favorable towards American aid to Israel, but not favorable to the continuation of American aid to Indochina, are operating on a wavelength that the secretary does not particularly approve of. The secretary did call for a year-by-year approach to Indochinese aid, but that he would settle for what is now being discussed, the three-year commitment with a cutoff at the end of that time. Well, at the moment, there's nothing on either count because Congress has not acted on the president's request for $222 million in supplemental military aid to Cambodia and $300 million in supplemental aid to Vietnam. The secretary did allude to the potential problems that may arise with Congress on this matter and to the actual divisions that exist in this country and have existed for almost 10 years now on the issue of Indochina. That basically summarizes what took place here this morning at this extremely significant news conference held by Secretary Kissinger some three days after his arrival back in this country from the Middle East. Thus, from the International Conference Room at the State Department, this is Josh Darcy speaking. Technical director for this broadcast was John Cater. Funds for this program have been provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.